Thank you. So, yeah, so I'm going to continue this discussion of violence in planet formation. So this is Jean-Claude Van Damme, I think, if in the previous notation. And we've already heard a little bit about the successes of this model. To go in those a little bit more detail. The fact that relatively simple models appear to do quite a good job at reproducing the eccentricity distribution of extrasolar planets. However, as we heard from Sean yesterday, some of us at least are quite interested in using this as a sort of part of a larger picture that would include, for example, looking at how terrestrial planet formation might vary in different systems. So I think we want to be fairly critical about the successes. So I also want to say something about what you might diplomatically call non-successes. So things that don't work quite so well. And then obviously we need more tests, say a little bit about that. And then finish up saying something that we've been working on recently. So this is mostly going to be a review of mostly other people's work. Finish up with some work we've been doing on trying to relate this to the outer solar system and try and ask how, in general, you might expect scattering to play out in the outer regions of planetary systems. So before getting started with that, though, as we've sort of already heard, I think it's wise to sort of keep in mind the bigger picture here. There's been a lot of work over, what is it now, 10 or 15 years, trying to identify the different processes that might play a role in shaping the overall distribution of planetary systems. So not just the eccentricity, but the masses of planets, their radii, their inclinations, all these properties. And I think, you know, if you sort of look at that and just look at what people have done, what do you expect? Well, you sort of expect it to be a real mess, because there are many processes which very plausibly do take place as the planets are forming and soon after they are forming. And some of those processes are at least, you know, reasonably well understood. Those ones, here's a bunch of them, which basically just involve gravity and n-body dynamics. So something like a Kozai resonance, which you heard a little bit about yesterday, is obviously a process that's very well understood on a fundamental basis. But as we've also had some discussion about, the problem with these things is that we still don't know how important they are, because in general, we don't know enough about the initial conditions to know if these are occurring very rarely, frequently, or perhaps in all systems. So again, for Kozai resonance, say, we probably don't know enough about the distribution of companions that could actually excite that process. But that's still better than the other class of processes, which we've also heard a little bit about. There are other things that we definitely know to happen. And these are things that are connected with the gas in the protoplanetary disk, because at least if we think about gas giants, clearly there is gas around, and there will be an opportunity for the gas to interact with the planets. So whether it's a dominant process or not, we obviously have to consider the possibility of type 2 migration when planets have formed. And these processes are very poorly understood, because they involve, in general, turbulent properties of the gas. And as we've heard extensively, these are poorly understood. Note here just how poor that is. This is a bold theoretical prediction here. The gas disk either damps or excites the eccentricity of planets. So remember to cite me when you know, when that turns out to be correct. Okay, so given that, it's a surprise, I think, even though it's now something that we've known about for many years, that if you just consider planet-planet scattering on its own without worrying about these other processes, which is clearly unrealistic, you can do a good job at explaining one important feature of the exoplanet distribution. So not the whole distribution, but the eccentricity distribution, which is an important dynamical property. And the basic idea here is sort of that you need to make a fairly bold assumption that is not so easy to justify from first principles. And that's that all giant planets, or at least a large fraction of them, at small distances, so the progenitors of the population that are actually being observed in radial velocity surveys, form in multiple systems, so at least two planets, better would be to have three or more, that are unstable to gravitational interactions over long time periods. And we've heard that, you know, that does have some support from sort of earlier calculations of planet formation, but it's by no means obvious that this actually happens in the bulk of systems. But if it does happen, it's now well established what happens. Those systems relax by a combination of processes, by typically ejecting planets, that's often the dominant channel, at least fairly far out, collisions with the planets, with the star, or collisions between the planets themselves. And the survivors of that process, when everything is shaken out, have an eccentricity distribution that matches that which is seen. This, as I say, has been known at some level for a number of years, but there are these couple of papers from a couple of years ago now that really worked through this in a lot of detail and also took advantage, of course, of the fact that the data has been improving a lot. So this is a nice model. For those of you who are Apple fans, you know, it's magical and revolutionary, and it's at an unbelievable price, so go down to your Apple store. So let's just go through how this works, and in the simplest case, where you don't have to worry about planetesimals, you don't have to worry about gas, this is a very simple calculation that can be done. You know, it doesn't take a large amount of computer time. So let's just describe it in a sort of very idealized numerical experiment. Let's start with three massive planets with masses that are drawn from the observed exoplanet mass function, and which have some radius that's maybe a little bit larger than Jupiter, because this process would be happening early when the planets are still a little bit puffed up. We imagine they start in cold orbits, so zero eccentricity and some negligible inclination. And let's place the inner planet at 4.5 AU. So then we have two more planets, which we're going to place outside those, and we'll give those a fixed spacing of four mutual Hill radii. And if you give them that kind of spacing, I'll come back to this in a moment, that yields systems that are typically unstable on a sort of useful timescale. Not very, very short, not one or two orbits, but not tens of billions of years. So it gives you something that's sort of useful. And we'll evolve those for 30 million years and look at the statistics of the ones that do something during that period. And that's the vast majority. That's 80 or 85% with these initial conditions. And a good fraction of the remainder would probably also become unstable if we were able, or more patient indeed, to run these things for longer. And this is what you get. So here's the distribution. This is eccentricity. This is the cumulative distribution on the bottom, differential distribution on the top. This gray band here is what is seen for giant extrasolar planets. So this is from Jason Wright's compilation. Obviously, we ignore the true hot Jupiters, where tidal effects are going to be important. We also restrict things to 10 Jupiter masses here. And you can see you get a very nice match between the theoretical prediction and the observations. So it's a very impressive agreement, given how simple the assumptions and the experiment are. And of course, so that was with the data as of a few weeks ago. But this is a well-known result. It's been done a number of times. Here are examples from this Chatterjee paper. This is Jurek and Tremaine here. Again, these are cumulative eccentricity distributions that are plotted. And it's not the case that this is a sort of completely universal process that will always give you this distribution. It's not a sort of magic distribution that you always end up with. So these calculations make different assumptions, in fact, about the initial conditions and various other aspects of the calculation. But it is true that a reasonable diversity of unstable initial conditions, if you make that assumption, do evolve sort of roughly similarly and can give something that is plausibly like what you see. So it is a reasonably robust method. It doesn't, you know, depend on having exactly two planets always, or exactly three, or details like that that would clearly be unrealistic. Now, there are some other aspects of the distribution that are also consistent with the idea that the eccentricity distribution is largely established by scattering. Here's one plotted in observational space here. So this is, I think, from the Wright et al. Paper last year. This is eccentricity. Here plotted as a function of this theta parameter, which is the ratio of the escape velocity from the surface of the planet to the Keplerian velocity. So this is a measure of how effective you would expect the planet to be at scattering. So if you're off to the right, we think about objects that are pretty good at scattering. So if they've been scattering other objects that are sort of like themselves, you would expect, well, maybe they will have ended up with higher eccentricity. And indeed, there is some correlation, not tremendously strong here, of the eccentricity with this parameter. Then another one, which we've been quite interested in, concerns looking at the distribution of planets in multiple planet systems, where you've had more survivors of the process than just one, or you've been able to observe more survivors. And there are now a number of those systems known, and so if you start with three planet initial conditions like we have, some fraction of those systems end up with two planets. And you can ask, how close together are those planets? And that's what's plotted here. So this is, again, a cumulative distribution. And the separation of the planets is sort of plotted in slightly funny units to take account of the fact that if you have planets of different masses, how close they could possibly be is we're limited by stability. So what we're plotting here is the separation distribution of planets in units of the minimum that is required for Hill stability, as determined by a number of authors. And again, the gray curve is what is observed as of about a year ago, and the red curve here is a scattering model very similar to the one I was just showing before. So there's obviously a lot of caution needed here, because I think the statistics of multiple planet systems and the possible biases and selection functions there are really very poorly understood, and there aren't many systems. Nonetheless, it's clear that the observed systems do tend to cluster pretty close to this minimum separation needed for Hill stability. And that's also what you get, what you expect based on this relaxation process. So again, it's consistent with what you see. So this is all good, and I think this is impressive, and I'm sort of certainly quite a fan of this idea that scattering establishes the eccentricity distribution. But we also have to remember, obviously, that other scenarios are certainly still possible. And so some of those other mechanisms on that first slide unquestionably occur. One other idea I quite like is the suggestion that maybe the gas disk is responsible for exciting eccentricity, at least up to modest levels. And I think there's some numerical evidence of that very possibly happens, at least for fairly massive planets, maybe two Jupiter masses and above. And it may be that the simulations or our knowledge of the gas disk is poor enough that that could be pushed down to smaller masses if there was a lower viscosity in the disk, for example. And in that case, you could easily get to 0.3, 0.4, 0.5 just from the gas on its own. And that, of course, would explain, in general terms, the majority of observed systems. It might not have the right distribution. That's hard to predict. And you can obviously imagine getting a high eccentricity tail by all manner of other processes. We've already heard that COSI, for example, is quite attractive in producing the very highly inclined hot Jupiters that are being detected over the last year. So sort of in the spirit of being unbiased here, we should ask, are the weaknesses to the planet-planet scattering story? And I guess you can see I'm obviously not going to be probably unbiased, am I? But so one issue which has been around for quite a while is physical collisions. And so these are interesting because they potentially lead to a radial variation in the eccentricity distribution that can also be predicted from these models, basically without introducing any further free parameters. And the idea here is simply that the fraction of instabilities that lead to physical collisions depends on that scattering parameter that I was showing before. And so as you go to smaller orbital radii, the fraction of collisions, which is only 10% or thereabouts out at 4 or 5 AU, starts to become larger. And at 0.5 AU, the fraction that ends up with physical collisions is more like 50% for reasonable planet radii. So it's really a very high fraction of systems in which at least one collision is taking place. And if you take two planets that collide from low eccentricity orbits initially, so if you have a multiple planet system, of course, they don't necessarily have to start from low eccentricity orbits. But if they do, then the merger product also has low eccentricity. And this has been known for a long time. And in fact, early calculations that were only considering equal mass planets, this was really quite a serious problem for matching the overall eccentricity distribution. There were too many collisions, and that produced two circular orbits. Now, this concern has gone away when you consider more realistic mass distributions. So the calculations I showed before did include physical collisions, and they matched the distribution very, very well. But the physics of this effect, of course, is still true. And so we expect a weaker effect, generally, unless there is significant initial eccentricity. Obviously, you can always get away with this if you say the initial planets already have eccentricities of 0.1, 0.2 emerging from the gas, in which case there's nothing you can say. So I'm going to say that I think this may be true, but this is sort of cheating, because if you assume that the planets have an eccentricity of 0.1 initially, then if implicitly you're saying that the gas disk is able to excite the eccentricity, and then really there's no reason not to say the gas cannot get up to much higher eccentricities than just 0.1. So how does this work? Well, this is the same set of calculations I showed before. So this is the observed distribution, now just in the cumulative plot. And here are the planets between a quarter of an AU and one AU. So there's about 50 objects in this innermost bin, and those two distributions are statistically equivalent. So there's no evidence for a change in the eccentricity distribution with radius. And here, then, is what you predict. So here's the 4.5 AU prediction, which agrees very nicely both with the whole distribution and with this inner sample. Here's what you get if you repeat the identical experiment at 1.5 AU. And here's what you get at 0.5 AU. And so you can see that the inner objects. I mean, it's not actually, you're not getting circular, you're not getting a whole bunch of circular objects here because it is a more complicated system, but you do get this trend towards more circular orbits. So this is just a sort of idealized calculation. We've done calculations where you try and make this comparison a little bit more robust. So we've tried to match the masses and the actual orbital radii of these observed systems and see if that makes a difference in various other things. But most models are disfavored at about this level, which is, you know, 99% or thereabouts. So it's not overwhelming, but it is interesting, perhaps, that you don't see this effect in the data. Obviously, a big question here is that, you know, to make this statistical comparison, you do need to assume that the observed eccentricities are unbiased, particularly at the low eccentricity end, because what happens in these collision models is that the collisions overpopulate those planets with eccentricities less than about 0.1, so it's basically pushing more objects into that low eccentricity bin. So it does matter that the observations are good in that region. Now, a similar thing, a related thing, is the mass-eccentricity correlation. And here, this is a correlation that is observed. More massive planets have higher eccentricity than less massive planets. Again, the significance is not enormous, but it's reasonably clear. So here's eccentricity, a cumulative fraction. The gray solid curve here is known exoplanets with masses below a Jupiter mass in M sin I. And then the dotted curve is those with masses above a Jupiter mass. You can see the senses as I described. And we have some models here plotted in blue and red. And here, the good news is that scattering is predicting, as you can see very nicely, actually, the right magnitude of the effect here. But if you, you know, look at the which curves are solid and which are not, the bad news is that the sign is flipped. So you know, maybe we've just made a mistake and taken the wrong sample of our data, but I don't think so. And this makes sense, right? It's in a scattering model, it's easier to excite the eccentricity of a low-mass object than it is a high-mass object if they have an interaction. So you expect the low-mass objects that survive should end up, on average, being more eccentric than the high-mass objects. So this is another thing that is of interest. And we looked at this, and the difference is not so large that it is inconsistent with a sort of more generalized scattering picture. In particular, what we showed was that you can reverse this sort of natural prediction of scattering if you assume that there are correlations between the masses of planets in the same system. And the way you need it to work is that if you have massive planets, they need to have formed in concert with other massive planets, because that maximizes the scattering efficiency for that given mass. That's the best mass function that you can have. Whereas low-mass planets, you know, those were part of systems that included a whole range of planet masses. So that's sort of a plausible thing, but again, it's something that one has to add in as an additional element. It's not the immediate prediction of the model. So I'll say a little bit more now about some tests. But first of all, I just want to briefly say, well, you know, what does this mean if this is correct? If one agrees, if one believes that scattering is the origin of this eccentricity correlation, eccentricity distribution, what does that imply for the earlier stages? And clearly this, what I've described here, is in no sense a complete theory, and it's not obvious at all that in fact there is a distinguishable stage of purely n-body evolution that can be separated cleanly from the stage of planet formation, which is clearly much messier and more complicated, and we've heard about that already. However, clearly you can draw some sort of qualitative conclusions. You require that multiple cores form and typically grow into a system of several massive planets. I think that's very plausible based on everything we know. You also need that the separation of those planets is such that the instability occurs on this timescale that's neither too short, in which case the gas would always be important during the scattering process, nor extremely long, in which case the planets might formally be unstable, but it would be on much longer than the lifetime of the system. And you can sort of plot this, and the potential problem is that at a given mass, so this is for planets of one Jupiter mass here, the range of separation, so this is separation ratio of a pair of the planets, the range of separations that gives you that desirable timescale is rather small. So even though you might be able to have six orders of magnitude in difference in instability time from, you know, just thousands or tens of thousands of years up to billions of years, the way this works, this still ends up being a small range of radii. So there's a potential worry about fine-tuning here. Is there too much fine-tuning in the initial conditions? And I don't know the answer to that. One thing I would observe, which sort of comes back to some of the things we've already heard about, is that the required initial conditions, the required separations, are spanned by a range of interesting mean motion resonances. This is 2 to 1, this is 3 to 2, it's 5 to 3 in the middle. And for some masses between, say, a Saturn mass up to a number of Jupiter masses, you could imagine a scenario where planets formed close to or in those resonances, and if you could eject them from those resonances at late times, they would be at the right sort of separations where scattering would happen on an interesting timescale. Okay, so how can we do better? How can we test some of these ideas? Well, one idea is, of course, just to do basically the same things, except better, with better data. And here, obviously, larger samples would be helpful, but I think it's important to realize that you don't need much larger samples. In fact, we already have a lot of planets. You're enough to make a good statistical comparison already. So what's actually shown here is the predicted median significance as the blue line for detecting this effect of the collisions on the radial variation of the eccentricity distribution. So, and this is the number of planets you'd need in the inner radius bin to see that at a given significance. So we have about 50 planets now, so we should start seeing these effects at about 3 sigma. At the moment, they are not seen. And with double the sample, you really should start to see those things if, in fact, the samples are unbiased. So I don't think you really need many more planets. I think what's more important here is work to determine the selection functions of these surveys and therefore whether, in fact, the statistical errors are the dominant source of error in making the comparison between the theory and the data. And there's, of course, been work on that already. Then there's some other tests, and one I rather like is this one that was discussed in a couple of papers last year of looking for very long period planets. And this is rather nice because this is a sort of fairly distinctive prediction of scattering that's really quite different from the things we've been looking at before. And the idea is that scattering predicts that there should be a small fraction of extremely long period planets. So semi-major axes, 100 AU, 1,000 AU, maybe even 10 to the 4 AU in some cases. And the reason for this is that in some fraction of systems, the ejection of planets occurs via a phase, maybe lasting a million years or thereabouts, during which the planets have this extremely distant separation from the star. So they're eccentric objects. So here's a plot from this paper by Verass et al. From last year. It's time down here. Here you're at 10 million years, so this would obviously only occur in young systems. And these dots out to the right here are these very long period planets. I should emphasize, these would be highly eccentric. There's no reason they'd be massive, so these are not like HR 8799. These would be something different. Now here's a plot from the other work. This is Schaff and Manu from also from last year. The percentage of the population at larger separation as a function of the projected separation. The red curve here is the initial conditions, and then these other curves here are showing what happens at later times. So these papers make clear that this is a rare effect. These would be rare systems. You'd have maybe 1% or less than 1% of the population that has planets, that is undergoing this scattering, are expected to have planets at this very large radius at, say, 10 million years. So it's a rare thing and hard to see, but it's interesting because even one detection of a low-mass planet, so something like a Jupiter-mass planet that could not have formed from gravitational instability, we believe, that's eccentric, out at beyond 100 AU, is really quite a strong evidence in favor of this kind of scattering picture. Okay, so let me then just finish with a couple of slides on possible links to what we heard about in the outer solar system this morning. As we noted, the dynamical influence of small bodies is thought to be critical in outer solar system evolution. And we expect those sort of outer disks of debris to be quite ubiquitous in planetary systems, because basically they arise from the fact that it becomes increasingly hard to form a giant planet core that could accrete gas during the lifetime of the gas disk if you go far enough out. So generically, we might in fact expect that in systems where we have giant planets, initially there was a massive disk of debris of 10, 50, 100 Earth masses out at larger radii. Now, why is that something that we shouldn't have been considering already in thinking about the eccentricity distribution? Well, this kind of planetesimal scattering is generally negligible at small radius, even if in fact there's some material there. And that's because the mass of debris within a few Hill radii, which is what matters for planetesimal scattering, would be much smaller than a massive planet mass. But it should become more important as radial velocity surveys push out to larger radii, where you should have things that are more like the solar system in that sense. So here's a movie of how this kind of thing works. It's a very static movie, as you can see. Oh, no, there we go. just a large movie and a slow laptop. So here's the disk of debris. Here's three planets. These are fairly low-mass planets. And the main point here is that the introduction of these small bodies introduces new physical possibilities that are not present in just a three-body, n-body system. So you can have this converging or diverging migration that some people think is very important in the solar system. You can have resonance capture. You can have damping of scattered planets if the planets do not have too high a mass. And that's what's going to happen here. So we've had 60 million years of complete tedium here. But if we wait a little bit longer, there we go. You get a scattering event that ordinarily would produce quite high eccentricities. But here, low-mass planets have been scattered into this disk of debris, and it gets recircularized. So we've looked at this with an ensemble, very large ensemble of integrations with this kind of initial condition, three planets, an exterior planetesimal disk. So what do you get from that? Well, you do indeed get systems in which both planet scattering, just among the planets, and then interactions with the disk are important. They're sort of equally competitive. And you sort of make two predictions from that. One is that if you consider the lower mass planets, which are obviously those most likely to be affected by disks of small debris, you predict a transition to low eccentricity orbits for these lower mass planets. That's what's shown here in terms of the total mass of the final system. If you don't have these planetesimal disks, you have some variation of the mass function with of the eccentricity distribution with mass. That's what I was describing before. But then if you add in these disks, the high-mass objects look pretty much as they did before, but then when you get below Jupiter mass in total system mass or thereabouts, you start getting a large fraction of circular systems, and they're really not just a little bit more circular, they become much more circular, so they're much more like the solar system. And then if you go to higher masses, well, in that case, you're not able to really circularize the planets, but if the planets are reasonably close to resonance to start with, the dynamical effect of the planetesimals can be enough to drive them into resonance. Can push the system together and converge them into mean motion resonances. And what we find in these calculations is a very large fraction of resonances and a reasonably large fraction of resonant chains. So planetary systems, maybe in fact like HR8799, where you have things that are more like the Laplace resonance in the Galilean satellite system. So these kind of systems, which are maybe not that much beyond those that are being seen in current radial velocity surveys, may be some kind of bridge between the very violent case that we seem to think happens in exoplanetary systems and the somewhat more quiescent evolution that's believed to happen in the outer solar system. So let me finish there. I think the nice thing about planet-planet scattering is that it involves this bold hypothesis, but given that, it makes predictions with a relatively small number of free parameters. So it's a fairly well-defined model. So if you're an optimist, you can look on the left-hand side of this diagram. There is this very good agreement, this very impressive agreement of the prediction with the observed eccentricity distribution. There are near-term tests that require better statistics, but not many more planets. And then there are other possibilities, such as the idea of observing these very long period planets. Then that last thing I was saying, if this is what is going on generically, then by combining this with what might happen in outer planetary systems, there may be a bridge to solar system dynamics. Now, if you're not such an optimist, more pessimistic, you could say that, yeah, this agreement is very impressive, but there's actually no unambiguous evidence of other correlations that also point in the same direction. So it's not as if we've made better progress than we had from a few years ago. And so I certainly think it's still worthwhile, therefore, to think about other ideas, things like disk excitation, things like Kozai resonance, as maybe those being equally or more important than this planet scattering in producing what we see. So I guess I'm somewhere in the middle here, so I will sort of stand in the middle of this plot and answer any questions. Thank you.
Question over there. We'll take Scott first, please.
So I know that one of the generic predictions of this model is that you should have a lot of free-floating planets, right, that are ejected from the system. It's not clear to me, and has never been clear to me, exactly how if there's a robust prediction for that, because it seems to me that you can start with a number of different scenarios and end up with an eccentricity distribution that roughly corresponds with what is observed. But it would be nice to know if there is a robust prediction, because as I presented in my talk, the MOA collaboration has constraints on free-floating planets that is, you know, sort of indicating one or some per star, and those will only get better in the next few years, and so this seems like a very critical test of this model.
Yeah, so I agree that is another. So there's, if you like, a period that the planets are very, very long periods that are actually completely escaped the system. So I think that is another critical test. Unfortunately, there isn't a robust prediction. All you can say is that there should be at least one, because the dominant channel is ejection. So to get the eccentricities, you need to eject roughly one planet per system on average. But it could be much higher than that. And that then comes back to these formation questions that Ed was talking about. You know, what is the typical number of gas giants that is formed in a system? So it's one or more.
I have a question about that statement just quickly. When you say that the limit is two or three planets per star, is that for all stars or just a range of stellar masses? What's the normalization? So it's actually an awful lot then, in a sense, right? Okay, sorry. Okay, next question.
Getting back to the mass eccentricity correlation, this was actually one of the things that we were really pleasantly surprised, and I say surprised because we didn't predict it, to get out of our planet synthesis calculations. And when we went back and looked at it and tried to figure out why this was happening, basically it's exactly what you were saying. It's the more massive disks that tend to make more massive systems of planets. And the one other thing to add to that is they also tend to make more planets. So basically, the more massive disks make systems that give you the highest opportunity for dynamical interactions was what we got out of this.
Do your simulations, and especially the ones with just the planets doing the scattering later on, produce any what I would call dynamically interesting multi-planet systems, either in resonance or where the planets interact significantly enough that there are substantial periodic or non-periodic changes in orbital elements?
Yeah, so the first part in resonance, you do produce some systems that are in resonance. You produce them in basically a trivial way, in the sense that, you know, when scattering takes place, there is some phase space that is resonant, and you basically populate that according to how much phase space you have. So you do produce some resonant systems, and you can obviously therefore produce some resonant systems that are high order resonances that, you know, would maybe be hard to set up from a gas disk. But of course the planets are not, at least in the pure n-body case, are not very deep in resonance, because they just happen to be somewhere in the resonance. So you can produce some systems like that. And the distinguishing feature is, yes, they're weakly in resonance. In terms of other kind of interesting activity, there's not so much, because typically the interesting dynamical phases here are, of course, very, very early on. And so when you get out to late times, unless you're in this resonant configuration, which is interesting, I don't think there's too much interesting.
Is it possible to get the mass eccentricity correlation by late-stage planetesimal damping instead of the way Ed described?
Yes, so we looked at that, and indeed you can certainly do that. You could make everything more eccentric and then just damp down preferentially the low mass objects. So that certainly could happen. I guess our argument was that it's hard to make that work at the radii where you see planets today. And in particular, you know, maybe you can make that work for the furthest objects in the radial velocity sample, but then you'd have to worry about the fact that the lower mass or the closer in objects also have the same sort of eccentricity distribution. So at least if you're doing it by dynamical friction, and there are actually other possibilities where maybe you could do it with a collisional disk if it was a much, much different properties of the planetesimals. But if you do it with dynamical friction, I think you'd need an unreasonable amount of mass close in to make that work for what we see now. But it could happen further out.
So, Dave Spiegel, how are these comparisons between the observed and calculated eccentricity distribution functions affected by the fact that I think Eric Ford and Margaret Pan and Ed Turner and a few others have talked about the fact that for the observed eccentricities, there's a bias towards higher eccentricity?
I don't know, maybe Eric should comment, because that's... Eric's done a lot of these comparisons, and then it's also his
I think if you look below, say, 0.05 or maybe even 0.1 eccentricity, then you have to worry. But if you kind of say, well, anything that they say has eccentricity of 0.1 isn't going to have eccentricity of much more than 0.1. So it's only that leftmost portion of his diagram that's going to shift things around. And the right-hand portion beyond that's all basically unaffected. So there is an effect, but it's only a small region of the diagram.
You mentioned you were worried about the fine-tuning and the planet scattering and the fact you needed the space carefully in Hill radii. But isn't it the case that if you tend to make crowded systems initially and let them self-regulate, then you're always doing a strong event of some sort approximately evenly in log time? So you always had a recent event, and you're always having an event sometime on a time scale comparable to the age of the system at the time of the event, in which case you don't fine-tune. You're just always doing something interesting.
So I certainly agree with that. I mean, I think there is, so, you know, part of this is a purely technical concern that the easiest way to make certain everything works is to have the systems initially really being very unstable, which of course they might be, right? But then, you know, one has to admit that some fraction of the in-body calculations one does have not been self-consistent because they've had very early instabilities. The other point I think I would just note is that indeed there is this log distribution. But if you look at, you know, these median timescales for instability, there are also that also has a substantial width, and so there are also, you know, quite stable systems, even of course among configurations that on average are very unstable. And, you know, depending on exactly how you do the numerical experiment, it's not clear that there is room for a large fraction or even a modest fraction of completely inactive systems. So that I think is the question. You know, is there other objects where nothing happened? Or how many objects are there where nothing happened, and therefore you ended up with really zero eccentricity planets?
Phil, many of the extrasolar planetary systems are current constant watch, and as we noticed, more planets are discovered in them, which requires going back to the original data and reanalyze all the parameters, which may change the current eccentricity. Now, the question that I have is that whether this has been something that you took into account in your models or can be predicted from your models?
We've been recent entrants to this game, so we've been looking at this with, you know, basically the current sample. I think it's certainly, your point, of course, is completely correct. There has been substantial changes in individual systems over the years as, you know, the orbital fits have been refined and more planets have been discovered. I think the overall eccentricity distribution, there has also been some change in its observational characterization over, you know, 5 years, but probably, you know, not as much as that. So, you know, I think this is a concern. You know, is there systematic effects on the eccentricity of that kind?
Phil, there's one multiple planet system that Eric Fold and Fred Razio have worked on, which has a very clean signature of planet scattering, and that's the Upsilon Andromeda system. Is that something that you people like you doing this numerical modeling are keeping track of? And this is, for people who don't know about this, this is when there is an impulse perturbation on a planet in a multiple planet system, the surviving planets are left with a certain memory of that in the epsilon phases. And this is something I pointed out for Upsilon Andromeda, and it works out for Upsilon Andromeda. But I would think that it might be washed out some. Upsilon Andromeda might be a very special system in some ways. But statistically, you might look for a signature like that.
Right. So, as you know, of course, in most cases, the resolution of these instabilities involves many close encounters, which is the sort of confounding aspect. So, you know, we've looked a little bit at that. I think, for the bigger picture, I don't think I'm sort of cautious about it because I think, okay, so this is a case where, you know, there's clear extra evidence on the individual system of its past history, and it's supportive of this scattering picture. However, then clearly we also have systems where they're very deep in resonance, which are, you know, very good evidence for resonance capture within the gas disk, and obviously those have not undergone planet-planet scattering. So I think on the on the individual objects in the distribution, there are objects there that, that point in a variety of directions as to which processes are most important. And I think, from these models, one does not expect to see clean signatures in the majority of systems.
All right. Hey, Eric Ford, so you mentioned the lack of second-order predictions, but I would propose that the existence of correlation in the escape velocity from the planet versus the escape velocity from the star exceeding unity is a requirement for planet scattering to operate. And so if we compare systems that have such a planet to those that don't, we could predict a trend there. And at least last I checked a couple of years ago, it seemed to be plausible, but one of these kind of borderline results. Do you have thoughts on a reason why that correlation might not survive, or is that something that you also would think is a reasonable prediction?
I think that's definitely a correlation that's important, and I have not actually looked at this more recently, so I can only go by your result, which was again at this sort of intermediate range of significance where it was interesting but not yet definitive. So that's something that would be worth looking at again, and also looking at again the predictions in some of these various models.
Question up front.
Hi, I'm Amit Hill. Yeah, I was wondering, in the various planet scattering models that I've looked at in the literature, you do reproduce well this distribution in eccentricity, but not that of inclination. Now, the scattering also produces a population of planet which is far away from the star. The inclinations that you produce are above 30 degrees, so they should induce cosine cycles to the inner body. How is that not happening?
Okay, so first of all, I would agree with your first statement that, of course, we've looked at the inclination distributions you get from this, and you get a broad range of inclinations, but you don't get extremely high inclinations. So you might get 30 degrees, but indeed much higher than that is hard to get. I think the reason that's not happening, at least in a large fraction of systems, is that in our calculations, where you start with this limited number of planets, then when you end up with two planets, they are typically actually fairly close together. So they're not in the classical setup for cosi resonance. Obviously, if you could have different circumstances. So for example, if you had more, as Jurek and Tremaine set the problem up, with a very broad distribution of initial radii of giant planets, if you had a dynamically active system in the outer part, which gave you inclination out there, then indeed I think it would be a more favorable situation for cosi in the inside. I guess the other point to note is, of course, that if it's planets that are doing the cosi, then you do have to worry about the relativistic precession if you're doing it with planetary mass objects rather than stellar mass objects. That limits how far out the outer body could be.
One last question from Scott.
You mentioned that planetesimal migration, you said, was inefficient for close orbits. And I just had a thought that we know of systems like the most famous of which is 149026, in which the modelers tell us that the core mass of this planet is actually quite high, which I think implies that the surface mass density in the disk itself was actually quite high. So I'm wondering if there's at least some subset of systems that maybe some fraction we don't know yet, in which planetesimal disk scattering migration might be significantly more important in the inner regions.
Well, I think it's possible in principle, and Norm Murray and collaborators a number of years ago indeed had such a model. You do need in the inner, if you want to make basically hot Jupiters or things like hot Jupiters by inward migration through a planetesimal disk, you do need it to be extremely massive, because you need it basically to be of a mass comparable to the planet mass, and that's a large factor larger than you would expect. So I think the systems where you see a large core, it's more likely that more modest increases in the planetesimal surface density have had an effect on the planet formation, and then the migration has taken place by some other process. That would be my suspicion.
Okay, let's thank Phil one more time, please. And before we break for lunch, Adam has an